Steve Darden from Screenfish. Alex, it's great to chat with you. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
I was wondering, you know, I was wondering about the film's tone, because one of the things that I think has been so interesting to me about this film is the way that the sides are politically neutral. Like, we don't ever find out any one issue about this film. And all these factions, the ideas of how we divide them up, are all mixed up in this film in a good way. I was wondering why you decided to build the film off of that.
To be honest, I'm not sure. One thing is, not being clear about it in a sort of movie terms clear doesn't mean they're neutral. Mm. It just means they're unspecified.
Right.
Right. And I think there are actually clues within it. But it's to do with the language. It's to do with the film language. So cinema has for a long time been very, very obsessed with ultra clarity, ultra clear stating a question, and then ultra clear answering of a question. And interestingly, it's not just studios who get twitchy about that. It can also be audiences and journalists who get twitchy about that, because clarity is, in a way, reassurance, right? You know exactly where the filmmaker stands. You know where you stand in relation to the film. And that's fine. Lots of films can do that, but they don't all have to do that. And this one is more uncomfortable in some respects and less reassuring than that. However, I'd say there are clues. There are reasonably clear clues. The president, for example, is a fascist. And in what terms are they a fascist? What are they demonstrating their fascism through? Well, one of them is dismantling a legal system that could threaten them. One is by being threatening to journalists. Mm. They say at one point, don't go to DC. Journalists are shot on sight in DC. Well, that tells you something about that politician's relationship with the press, the way they perceive them. Three-term president, so they've been undermining the Constitution. To me, those things are actually quite clear. They're not really coded. They're just not telegraphed in the way a film normally telegraphs them and gives reassurance. But they are there. And I wouldn't say that's neutral. What it is the film is ultimately, in some ways, a film in favour of an old-fashioned kind of journalism, which was reporting, where explicit bias was removed from reporting in order that it was trusted. And so the film tries to function like reporters. It makes reporters the heroes, and then the film does the same thing. It just says, this is what it looks like. I guess that's the answer.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ridge from Comics Gaming Magazine, or CG Magazine.
Sure.
So for me, like, I'm really big into anime, and strangely enough, I remember in the past you mentioned how you... Attack on Titan, yes, for men. Like, I was wondering, because you know how there's so much politics in Attack on Titan, like, was there that kind of influence in Civil War?
I couldn't say explicitly from Attack on Titan, but I did enjoy Attack on Titan because it was having not just a political, but a kind of broad ethical conversation underneath the story the whole time, which I thought was smart and interesting, and I enjoyed it a lot. Civil War, really, its cues come more from non-fiction than from fiction. It's obviously it's a fiction story, but its points of reference are things like news footage, documentaries, and lived experience. And in fact, we went out of our way, like the group of people working on the film. We were really careful to avoid some kinds of film grammar at times. I mean, I could give an example. It's kind of a brutal example, but say film has over decades created a grammar about what happens when someone gets shot. So you've seen many films that have big fountains of blood and people flying backwards as if they're snapped on a cable, and there's something essentially cinematic happening there in the grammar. And if you were ever unfortunate enough to see someone get shot, or you watched it on some news footage, quite often what you see is it's just someone falling down, as if the lights have been switched off and they just fold and collapse. More than anything else, we were using people's experience of the world in one way or another to inform the look of the film, I would say.
Thanks.
Sure.
Hey, Alex.
Hey.
Kurt, we're in Canada. I wanted to put the spotlight on you. So over the last 10 years, we've done four films with four magnificent leading ladies here. Alicia and Ex Machina, Natalie and Annihilation, Jesse and Men, and obviously your Kirsten and Kaylee. And,
yeah.
Civil War.
Yeah.
So that being said, when you and Francine were in the process of finding your Lee and your Jesse, what is it that about both Kirsten and Kaylee made you stand out and be like, that's who, that's
it's it. Amazing that you just name checked Francine. That's a very specialist bit of knowledge. But well done.
Thank you.
It was different in both cases. Kaylee I'd worked with before. We worked on a TV show called Devs with another one, in fact several of the actors in truth, but within that car also Stephen McKinley Henderson, who sat right there. So I knew Kaylee and I knew Stephen well, and I knew, I, in a funny way, I was kind of writing to them because I know what they're like together and sort of on camera, off camera, that kind of thing. With Kirsten, I didn't know her, but I sort of knew her in the same way that you sort of know her, which is she's been around since she was a child actor. And so you see, she's one of those few child actors who then made the transition into being an older actor. And in a literal way, you've watched her grow up. I've watched her grow up. You've watched her grow up. We all have. And what that does is it means, number one, you're very familiar with her as an actor, what her abilities are, that she's got range, that she can contain in something like Melancholia something really soulful and sad. It's not all Spider-Man, as it were. There's lots of shades, lots of dimensions in her. But there's also a lot of lived experience. And in the case of a war photographer, you need that. You need to believe that. And not all actors have it. Not all actors have access to that kind of sadness or soulfulness. That's probably partly to do with them just as people.
Hi, Ben from the Dula Rana.
Hey.
So I feel like a common thread that runs through all your movies, whether it's ones you've written or directed and written as well, is this sense of existential dread that the characters have to reckon with.
Yeah.
So can you talk about why that's such a powerful theme for you to explore as a filmmaker, and how the Civil War expanded it?
I'll give you three guesses. you know, existentialism is a theory. It sort of came from the idea that it's sort of universally shared in a way, that there's a sense of angst that is common, and then they gave a name to it and looked for the reasons for it. I think I like the world very much, and I'm not misanthropic. I like people as well. But the world is also strange and disturbing. And I think, in some ways, writing is an act of processing. And so I am processing things that are concerning me. Now, sometimes that might be, I'm thinking, why are we treating tech leaders as if they're geniuses when really what they are is entrepreneurs? Like, what's that about? Like, that's the concern. And or what does certain kinds of AI imply, not just about machines, but also about us or something? In this particular case, I was really alarmed, you could call it existential, and frustrated, actually angry, with two things. One was the contempt that was being shown to journalists, which I thought was incredibly short-sighted, incredibly stupid, actually, and also dangerous, because journalists have a societal role, which is to protect you against corrupt governments. And I kept wondering, I still wonder, if Watergate happened now, would it have succeeded? Two journalists in the Washington Post brought down Nixon, who was a crook. Would that happen now? Probably, almost maybe manifestly not. It wouldn't happen now. There's something really strange there. That that creates an existential feeling in me, and also a feeling of anger. And also divided countries, divided states. What causes it? What's the engine? Populism. Where does populism lead? Extremism. Is extremism dangerous, particularly if it's not being mitigated by journalism? Yeah, it's really dangerous. It's not like a cozy, fun, playful, acerbic podcast that can play fast and loose without consequence. Actually, it's really, really dangerous. People can get hurt, people can get killed, people's lives can be made miserable. We have these systems of governments and the fourth estate, the press, actually to guard against something. If we dismantle the guard, then we're unguarded. So, existential, yeah.
Thanks. Hi, Alex.
Hey.
Kevin from the Can you talk to me about the evolution of Civil War as a story? I mean, you said that you wrote this script about 4 years ago, if I'm not wrong.
Yep.
Was it marinating for a while inside? Was it always from the point of view of the journalist? Can you talk about how it evolved?
It was always from the point of view of the journalist, and in a way it was marinating for a while. It was a growing sense of frustration, which I was just talking about. But I would say, I feel almost embarrassed sometimes that I write a story that then gets called prescient, and it's not true. One thing is, the situation now was pretty much identical 4 years ago. It just might be slightly worse, but it was essentially identical in most meaningful terms. Saying something like Ex Machina, a lot of people were talking about AI, a lot of people were making films about AI at the same time. There was a whole bunch of films about AI at the same time as Ex Machina. And I often thought, I'm not sure I'm saying anything that wasn't also said in 2001, which was decades before. But yeah, it was marinating for a while. Why did I choose to do it in this case with this particular film? It honestly was generated by anger. And then thinking, I need to control the anger, I need to modulate it, I need to make it thoughtful, I need to make it precise, I need to not be alienating. One of the things that happens when people get angry in a way is they shout, and whoever they're shouting at stops listening, right? Just turns into a punch-up or a shouting match or some online fucking bickering or whatever it is, and I wanted to avoid that.
Thanks. Yeah, Brett Jode from Range Magazine. You touched on a little bit earlier how the film is, like, what you believe and what you're saying is coded into the film subtly, where it's not neutral, but it's unspecified. So in making the story with that kind of politically opaque lens...
Semi-opaque.
Yeah, cinematically opaque, okay. How did you want that to kind of resonate with an audience that is, like you say, is increasingly divided?
That's up to them. I think that here's one of the realities about actually language or communication of the sort we're doing now. There's no real guarantee that you and I will agree, not just on what we're saying to each other, but agree on what is actually being said, right? Language is complicated. I'll give you an example. Governments make laws. They write the laws trying to be clear. And then judges and lawyers, their entire profession is about interpreting different meanings of the sentences written to be clear. Two people read the same book. One person says, this happened for this reason. Another one says, this happened for that reason. You must have had the experience of disagreeing with a good friend who you agree with about many things, but you disagree what is happening in a film and the reasons for which it's happening. It's in the nature of stories. It's in the nature of communication. I don't worry about it too much. I try to tell the story as truthfully as I can to my own criteria. I also try deliberately to leave space for the audience, because I'm not trying to cut them out of the process, because they cannot be cut out of the process. I could attempt to ask every question clearly and answer it all clearly, and you will still get different interpretations. So I choose to lean into that because I find it interesting. People have different interpretations on things I've given. It may not be my interpretation, even on something I've worked on, but I don't find it invalid, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thomas Alanides from One Take News. Something that I really liked about this movie is how it shows that the country is very much divided. It's kind of also spilled out into the reaction of this movie, which are divisive. It's a very big theme with this movie, and I think there's really no scene that exemplifies that better than Jesse Plemons' scene, where you see clearly someone on one side and someone on the other. It's a terrifying scene. It's the best scene in the movie. It's the most talked about thing. So I'm curious for you, what was it like shooting that scene? How did you evoke that terrifying feeling from Jesse and from all the other actors in it? Because it is really a fantastic scene.
We shot it in a particular kind of way. I think if you walked onto a film set, maybe you have walked onto film sets, what you often see is an actor or two actors or three actors, and then this massive semicircle of people who are really crowding them. They're like, the lens might be here. Sometimes the lens is actually, if it's a clean shot, in front of the actor, and they are kind of hovering behind the lens to give an eye line to the other actor. And of course, actors, that's their job, and they're very good at blocking that kind of stuff out, but it does always interfere, or it often interferes some way, somehow. So with this particular scene, we pulled everything back as far as we could. So it's shot on, it largely on long lenses, so you know, that is to say, not wide angle, but encompassing everything, but lenses designed to see something further away and make it feel closer, I suppose. And so we took all of the structures as far back as we could and shot on the longest lenses we could in order to get the cameras and the sound equipment and everything away from the cast and put them in a kind of bubble of intensity. And actually, on the neutrality front, just for what it's worth, that scene's quite a good example, because the people are being executed according to a criteria. Now, the film does not specify the criteria, it just does it, right? And that is non-neutral, but it's non-flagged, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And time for just the last question.
Sure. Hi, Tristan. French from KeepHopesMovies.com. Hey. I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the soundtrack, because I think you made some really interesting choices, and specifically about using Sergio Simpson's Breakers Roar. I thought that was a really powerful choice and an unexpected choice for that scene, and I just wanted to talk to you about why you chose that.
Well, one of the things actually was something to do with making a war movie, what is essentially a war movie, and the way music can be used and accidentally, in a funny kind of way, change the tone and make it too seductive or too enjoyable. So often the music choices are slightly jarring. They come in at a strange moment. Not actually in that example, though it might be subtly jarring, but then start to make a kind of sense. But it's particularly true if it's music alongside violence. Mm-hmm. You have to be thoughtful in terms of what effect these two things will have together. We tried to choose bits of music that, for a lot of people, would not be immediately recognizable. Because a whole bunch of extra information arrives with that, and also avoid really contemporary music, because that would date the film in a particular kind of way, and that also brought information in that we were kind of trying to keep out. So it was surprisingly complicated, and in the end, that means sitting with your phone in an edit suite, and it's me and Jeff and Ben, who are composers, and Jake, the editor, and we're kind of looking through our iTunes and Spotify and saying, do you think this might work? Should we try it? And sometimes you play it through the speakers of the phone, that's fucking terrible and it sounds shit, and then you download it and try to be discreetly confrontational in a funny kind of way with the choices.